And welcome to another episode of Gopher Gridiron Radio. I am Luke Buer.
And I'm GopherIllustrated.com publisher Ryan Burns, and we welcome you guys back to a, I shouldn't say somber breakdown edition, but a very interesting breakdown edition as we get to get into this 23-19 Gopher football loss on the road to Kinnick. The 20-year drought in Iowa City will continue. A lot of different facets of this game are going to be interesting to break down with not only Luke, myself, but my second cousin and former Golden Gopher offensive lineman, Derek Burns, is back from his work hiatus to join us. But Luke, before we start to get into any of that, do you want to give the folks a word from our sponsor?
Yeah, so again, the Goal Line Club is sponsoring the 2019 version of Gopher Gridiron Radio. If you want to participate in any of their remaining events for the 2019 football season, head to GoalLineClub.org. If you're not a member of the Goal Line Club, and holy cats, it sounds like a lot of you became members during their drive on Give to the Max, you can use the promo code AXED, A-X-E-D, and the number 5. AXED and the number 5. All right, Ryan and Derek, let's get into this one quickly. There's a lot to get into because we haven't done this in a while. We have to figure out how to come to grips with a Golden Gopher loss.
It's been 364 days in between losses.
That's pretty impressive.
That's wild. Yeah. Like, and I know that Ryan James tweeted that stat out on Saturday night, trying to give some perspective on things, and it's. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy just the way that this team has turned itself around here in the last year. And we'll get into it tonight. And you'll hear that, frankly, this is a game that Minnesota should have won by 10, 14 points. And I'll give my reasons why. And you should be a little bit ticked off about that. The team didn't execute in essentially every facet of the game of football. But they're still 9-1. They're still ranked 11th in the country. They still have a great shot at the Big Ten West. They just have to now take care of business in an axe game that is going to be as important as it's been in a long time. But it's not the end of the world. Like some people on Gopher Illustrated in my Twitter mentions are saying, they're still 9-1, Luke.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Big Ten West standings, they still have a game in hand. I know that it kind of doesn't really mean anything because you play Wisconsin at the end of the year. But if you take care of your own business, it doesn't matter. So it's still, again, like Derek has talked about many times on this podcast, meaningful football in November is really fun, and we're getting to live through it, and that's about as good as it can get. So before we get too far derailed from trying to talk people off the ledge, let's actually talk about this game, and then we can talk them off the ledge. The Gophers lose 23-19 at Kinnick Stadium. They haven't won since 1999 there. So, Derek, first of all, I just wanted to ask you, how hard is it to play in Kinnick?
As the records of the opposing teams would indicate, it's difficult, and it's one of the top two or three more difficult places to play in the Big Ten. You know, the things that I remember, it's the closest the stands and the crowd are to the field. There's not much space between the sideline and the field, so you hear a lot of places they talk about the crowd being on top of you, but that's really the case at Kinnick and Iowa City. And then, you know, it's a passionate fan base. They have a long-standing tradition. They are at or near capacity for every game, and they really show up for big games. And this is a really big game for both teams. And they're it's difficult. It's what you want. I mean, it's one of the things that you know differentiates college football, and in my opinion, is one of the things that makes college football great. But it's a big home field advantage for them, and I think it was on Saturday as well.
So obviously, Iowa got out to a huge lead early. I think it was actually 20-3. Was it 20-0 at one point even? I don't recall exactly. I know it was 20-3 for sure. But they got up quickly, and the Gophers had to, come back furiously trying to overcome that, and obviously had some blunders along the way in being able to do so. But Derek, I just want to ask you before we get into breaking this game down in quite detail, what's it like playing from behind? I don't know if you actually had this experience in your playing career, but I know in basketball it's really, really hard to play from behind because you have to put in so much effort on the defensive end, to try to come back, right? But what is it like from a football perspective to actually play from behind?
Well, you know, my experience as an offensive player is it gives an advantage to the defense because you become one dimensional, and especially, and I know we'll get into it in more detail later, but on Saturday you could just see the defensive line, which is already a very talented, athletic defensive line for Iowa. It really gave them, I mean, in my opinion, it really gave them an edge, and they were able to pin their ears back and play even more aggressive. And as an offensive lineman, and that makes it very difficult. If you're, you know, the obvious examples are if you're pass blocking and, you know, you're behind, you're mainly going to be pass blocking and in obvious passing situations. That's going to give it's, you know, your baseball analogy is if you know that a curveball is coming, it's a lot easier to hit a curveball. So, as a defensive lineman, you know you're going to pass rush. You know you're not going to have to check, draw, or run or something like that. You can really tee off. So it's difficult. It's, again, becoming one-dimensional is, you know, creates an advantage for the defense.
Especially when you have Hawkeye defensive lineman A.J. Epenesa, Chauncey Golston. If you didn't see it on Saturday night, A.J. Epenesa is going to be a first-round draft pick in the upcoming spring for a reason. He was sensational. Now, the suboptimal thing is you gave him essentially 85% of his snaps. He knew that Iowa had a two-score lead and they were at home, so all he had to do was pin his ears back and try to go at Sam Schluter or Blaze Andres or whoever it may have been, and that's obviously not ideal. Now, for as much as we like to talk about, and by we, me, the narrative street and the Sam Schluter revenge game, certainly didn't go like maybe some thought. A.J. Epenesa has 9 pressures on the day, according to Pro Football Focus, on 36 Tanner Morgan dropbacks. That'd be a 25% clip. Obviously not ideal. But when you look at the one-dimensional aspect of it, Minnesota essentially has to abandon their game plan because they're down 20-3 before they can really blink. And then you have to just go up-tempo. You have to go RPO. You have to do some different things to try and get some points on the board, especially knowing – what is Iowa really good at? Slowing the game down, draining the clock, and Minnesota's defense finally responded when it mattered. But allowing A.J. Epenesa and Chauncey Golston just pin their ears back, especially you saw on that final drive, Blaze Andres, if he never has to see Epenesa again, would be too soon, unfortunately, for that young man from Marshall. But allowing Iowa's defensive line, which was already really good, and there was going to be a mismatch for Iowa coming into this game with their physicality and their talent they have up front there, allowing them to, as Derek and I have said, pin their ears back, so to say, and know that they can just get after the quarterback. Obviously not ideal, Luke.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at Minnesota on the season, right, they probably run the ball about 65% of the time, maybe even more. I don't actually have the numbers in front of me. But you see this, they had to throw the ball 39 times to rush at 30. So obviously it took them out of their script that they normally want to run, right? And you know, to Iowa's credit, getting up had to be a part of the game plan early because, you know, getting the Gophers off their game, as we've said, made them one-dimensional and then made it all the more tough, all the more tough on the Gopher offense because now you have to execute instead of being able to catch guys off guard, etc. So I guess I do want to touch on the run game because this was an area that the Gophers struggled. On 30 team carries, they only had 63 yards for a 2.1 yard average. So Derek, what did you see from the Gophers in the run game against Iowa?
Well, a couple of they specifically schemed like to play against Iowa's defensive ends, and by that I saw at least 2 different plays that the Gophers introduced on offense to take advantage of the aggressiveness of Iowa's defensive ends. They ran a weak side toss, and then they ran their outside zone, but with some different influence blocking. What they tried to do was to get those defensive ends over pursuing, and I mean, unfortunately, they didn't work. The defensive ends for Iowa were too fundamentally sound. They didn't bite, but I have to give a little bit of credit on that respect that they knew going in they were going to have to try some new things, and sometimes that's what happens. You know, the other team can coach their players too and can scheme, and they ended up coming out on top in that regard. But the running game, besides that, I think was a couple of different factors. They were inconsistent. There were some plays they were able to get yardage. But Iowa uses a scheme with their defensive line that's different than any of the Gophers had seen so far this year. And you, most of the teams that play, in fact, most in college football, use just simply a one-gap scheme with the defensive line, meaning the defensive linemen are essentially there to take up blockers, and the linebackers are then there to make tackles and make plays. So really those defensive linemen are space eaters. And with Iowa, that's not the case. And I believe that the coaches scheme that way because of the athleticism and the talent they have in the defensive line. They allow those linemen to play two gaps. So when Gophers run zone against that, whether it's inside, outside zone, what Iowa did was many times try and engage in the block, extend, and then look into the backfield and play, and sometimes cheat backside or play front side, depending on where the running back was going. And so it's more risky to play that way, but it lets your defensive line be more athletic and make more tackles rather than just taking up space. And that, you know, against the zone scheme that the Gophers had, I think that really kept the Gophers in check because of the things we've mentioned, the athleticism on the defensive line that they have, and you know, the speed and the strength. I think that really it made for tough sledding for the Gophers. And the only thing I would add is I think with hindsight, if the Gophers had to go back, they might have run more wildcat. I think that with the exception of one play that I think Seth Green was stopped short on a short yardage play, I think the Gophers ran wildcat a handful of times and were able to be successful on most of those. And I think that kind of turns on its head the zone scheme, where you're not trying to stretch things out, you're not playing against that athletic, you know, speedy defensive line, you're just going straight at them. So I think if they had to do it over again and the game script were different, they might run some more wildcat, because I think they had, you know, more success with that.
All right, Ryan, I am curious, when we get into that, just kind of closing out the running game, you surprised Cam Wiley got run early?
Spoiler, Luke knows I am. Cam Wiley being a big part of this game plan was interesting to me. Him being the primary kick returner I'm for that, considering the kickoff return game has been anemic at best. We'll get into just the abomination that is Gopher special teams, but scheming Cam Wiley for the second touch of the game offensively over Brooks and Ibrahim was an interesting, I'd be curious to learn more about why. And that's not a shot at Cam Wiley. I think he's got a great future ahead of him. But the way that Brooks and Ibrahim have been playing of late, and even played in this game, to try and scheme him the ball in space was a little bit interesting compared to some of the other options that Minnesota had there. But the running game really just didn't have a chance to get going.
Right.
When you're down 20-3 halfway through the second quarter, and Iowa's already got a good defensive front, their linebackers are sound, their secondary is sound, and I believe the defensive coordinator for Iowa's name is Phil Parker. He's got a great defense, and they deserve a lot of credit for the way that they held Minnesota, especially when Minnesota got into Iowa territory. But the running game just really never had a shot. And say what you will, I mean, I had some folks asking about Rodney Smith. Does he look right? And he looks right, but you're not going to be able to have a lot of success running the ball against Iowa in Kinnick when you're down 17, 14 points. Now, Minnesota did find some success at times. That started with, I think, John Michael Schmitz. That Connor Olson played fine. Daniel Falele played better than what I was expecting, but it just couldn't really come together for that entire unit, especially sans Curtis Dunlap, who was banged up in the Penn State game. He did not play in this game. From what I've been told from sources, I expect him back from Northwestern, but even still, Luke, it needed to be done with the arm of Tanner Morgan, but good googly moogly, my man. I talked about this with Derek in the pre-production meeting, Luke. It was the amount of points that this Gopher offense left out on the field. It's really grinding my gears right now.
Yeah, so let's get into the passing game in particular, because they had to go become so one dimensional. They did that through the air. Tanner Morgan's stat line was 25 of 36 for 368 yards, one touchdown, 10.2 yard average. You know, I think most quarterbacks would take that, but for Morgan, that seems like a kind of a subpar game, especially in the average completion range. Most of his averages throughout a game are usually in the middle to high teens. But yeah, I mean, opportunities galore were missed. Maybe Ryan will give you the opportunity to, I think the proper word is probably vent a little bit.
Oh, I can hear Derek chuckling because he's already heard this venting session, but for as much as you can put on the defense not starting well or the special teams being terrible again or some questionable Fleck coaching decisions, it's the offense to me that takes the cake for this game. And I know that they did so much and moved the ball so well up until they'd get it to the Iowa 30. They shot themselves in the foot so many times that could have been points, that this could have been a 10-14, 17-point victory. I mean, if you even want to go drive by drive, Minnesota gets a 3rd and 9 at the Iowa 28, and then Tanner steps into a sack. Well, why did he step into a sack? Well, he saw that Connor Olson's defensive tackle went away, and he thought that he could step up and potentially move there. Well, if you see someone leave, Derek knows this better than anybody as a former Big Ten offensive lineman. If someone leaves, someone's probably coming. And Tanner walks into a sack. Minnesota attempts a 50-yard field goal. They miss it. Second drive of the game. Minnesota gets it all the way to 3rd and goal at the Iowa 6. And then A.J. Epinesa beats Sam Schluter on the outside. He gets there a half second early. If Tanner can just a half second earlier get that ball off, Tanner or Tyler Johnson's wide open in the back of the end zone. Epinesa hits Tanner as Minnesota is trying to get a touchdown. The ball sails high. Minnesota has to settle for a field goal. So minimum right here. So far through two drives, you've got between 4 and 7 points left on the table. Third drive of the game. Minnesota gets it 4th and 1 at the Iowa 28. Rodney Smith runs outside zone. Bryce Witham gets a terrible holding call because he did hold, but I have no idea why he held in that instance. He is in the slot. He knows the play is coming towards him. So when you're blocking your guy in that instance and you see him start to get jittery, you know, number one, Rodney's coming. And what does that mean? Number two, he's got the first down, so I can just let go. There's no point in me holding on anymore. We have the first down as an offense, and you have him sealed. Rodney can make that guy miss. So instead of a first down run on 4th down that puts Minnesota inside the Iowa red zone, Bryce Witham holds, play comes back. Now you're going to tell me, yeah, I'm well aware that Tanner picks it up. Well, then Rashad Bateman is wide open on a post, and he drops it on 2nd and 18. Rashad Bateman doesn't drop those. He hasn't dropped them all year. Minnesota then doesn't convert because of a dropped and a hold. So instead of 3 or 7 points on that drive, another drive in Iowa territory stalls out, and Minnesota punts from the Iowa 33. Then we get into the 4th possession of the game. Minnesota, once again, stop me if you've heard this before, gets into the Iowa red zone, and Tanner, on 3rd and goal, has A.J. Epinesa bull rushing Sam Schluter. Blaze Andrews is over there to help, but if he just slide steps a little bit to his right, he will see Rashad Bateman wide open breaking out of his route from the slot, but he's so visioned in on Tyler Johnson, of which, yeah, Tyler did get held. There was a penalty, but the time was your enemy there. He only had 6 seconds. You needed to get the playoff, and if he just shifts his vision one to the right, Bateman's there. It's a touchdown. So we're talking about, let alone in the first half, somewhere between 7 and 14, 17 points left on the board. And then you get into the 3rd quarter with Tyler Johnson dropping the easiest ball he would have had all night. Not only would have that been a first down again in the red zone, it could have been a touchdown. But it's an empty possession once again. So instead of 3 or 7, you get 0. It's the inefficiencies of this Gopher offense. And there was these untimely drops and untimely mistakes that had been uncharacteristic throughout the 9-0 run. Tyler Johnson wasn't dropping wide open balls in the red zone that cost you 7 or 3 points. Rashad Bateman isn't dropping wide open post routes that put you into the red zone, and instead of points, you get 0. Bryce Witham isn't holding. Tanner Morgan isn't missing throws because of pressure, different things like that. It was just these little details that Kirk Ciarocca talks about all the time with the media that really plagued this Gopher offense. Now, Derek, I know you've heard that spiel before, but is there anything I'm missing there with this Minnesota offense? Because I think Ciarocca put the players in a situation to make plays. It's just for the first time all season, they didn't make them.
Yeah, I think that we're at a point now with the speaking to the Gophers passing game where I don't believe that any of the other teams in the Big Ten outside of Ohio State can match up with the Gopher receivers. And I really mean that. Iowa plays quarters coverage. They have played it forever. they're usually doing well if they can really just mug and hold receivers on the outside, try to not to let them get loose. They mix in press. They sometimes play off. They mix in a blitz. But, I mean, on Saturday, the Gophers receivers were, they had got out of their breaks. They ran their routes. There was, they weren't able to consistently cover the Gophers. And that's just a theme we've seen all year. And especially in a game that Luke started off with, they're one-dimensional. I mean, Iowa knows they're going to pass most of these times, and they still can't cover them. So that certainly wasn't, you know, that continues to be a bright spot, and it wasn't an issue on Saturday in terms of the receivers getting open. And as you mentioned, the game plan for passing I thought was excellent. But I'll just echo your comments with they're just the untimeliness of the drops and or the sacks, you know, the unnecessary sacks or the tip balls or, you know, you got to give Iowa some credit too. You know, they made plays when they needed to. I mean, it was inside of inside of the 30-yard line. They needed to make a play. They would make a play and just enough. And when you play a team like Iowa, and you mentioned it earlier, Ryan, with the way that they play and try to melt the clock, ultimately they're trying to limit possessions. And so if you get a lot of possessions, you can afford to make some mistakes because you can come back with a big play on the next possession. You can score fast. Well, what Iowa does is they try and, you know, even though they throw the ball this year a lot more than they historically have, they still try, especially when they have a lead, they still try and limit possessions. So if you let one of those possessions where you drive 50 or 60 yards and you don't come away with points, it's just a killer because you're not going to get that possession back because they're not going to turn the ball over. And so those handful of little things that you mentioned are just magnified, and that's the game they've played. That's the way they coach. That's the type of team they are. And it definitely worked in their favor on Saturday.
All right, Derek, I did want to ask you just about, you know, Minnesota's offensive athletes comparing them to Iowa's defensive athletes. I think Ryan already touched on this a little bit with, you know, Epineza, et cetera. But can you touch on that real quick?
On which position group specifically? Just anywhere?
Just even looking at – this was the first time, I think, that Minnesota's played Iowa offensively that Minnesota had the better skill position players. In terms of Minnesota's running backs and wide receivers compared to Iowa's secondary and their linebacking core. Now, obviously, Minnesota's got some work to go to compete with what Iowa does in the trenches, but it seemed like at times that Iowa's secondary was running in molasses compared to what some of these Gopher receivers were doing, or even Tyler Johnson on that 4th-and-4. If you go back and watch that play, what Tyler Johnson does to get open there is incredible. The Iowa slot corner is tilted inside on him, plus he's playing his inside shoulder. He knows the slant is coming. He's playing the slant, yet Johnson is so explosive in a phone booth, he can still create separation and get open. But to me, Derek, this was the first time that I watched a game against Iowa, and I left thinking, this was – Minnesota had the better athletes in terms of on the skill position side of things.
Yeah, I would say if we could just turn the page back a couple of years, I remember breaking down a game with you guys where it was flip-flopped. The corners, specifically the outside press corners for Iowa, were, you know, they're probably playing in the NFL now if I were to go look it up. But in Minnesota, did not have talent on the outside. I can remember that game, and I think it was 2 years ago, so it would have been the last time at Kinnick. They didn't. You know, Gophers just couldn't get off of coverage the whole day. They couldn't get a hitch. They couldn't get a stop route. I mean, nothing. And like I mentioned, you know, just to start off the talk about the passing game, that certainly wasn't the case on Saturday. The Gophers receivers were able to get off coverage. They respected Bateman's speed, but he's still able to come back with, you know, deep slants and crosses, you know, wide open. So I think in the secondary, there's no comparison. I think Minnesota was definitely more athletic in the skilled positions, and probably linebacker position, you know, was not where I was normally at, and I don't think was an issue athletically. But the defensive line, I definitely think they had the edge. That was for the second game in a row, I think, you know, Penn State and Iowa's defensive line have been the best that the Gophers have faced this year. But I think the edge for was to Iowa on Saturday because of the game script. You know, Penn State, the Gophers matched up a little better, were able to move the ball more consistently, but a lot of that was because the Gophers had the lead. The Gophers were scoring, or it was a one-score game. It was kind of back and forth. So Penn State was much more on their heels, where this game, you know, being down 2 to 3 scores early, just it gave that much more edge for Iowa's defensive line.
Right, and you actually, I think on the broadcast they noted that P.J. Fleck in as a head coach is, what, 0-12 when he leads, when he's down at the half, right? So Minnesota and I guess P.J. Fleck-led teams, you know, when down and can't follow their normal script, haven't been notoriously successful. I think that actually moved to 0-13. Okay, Derek, one thing I did want to touch on, I know people are going to want to know what you thought, you know, with the Gophers offensive line, sans Curtis Dunlop, what you saw out of that group.
Yeah, I think it was a mixed bag on the offensive line. As Ryan mentioned, 2 or 3 of the guys, I think, played okay. I think they struggled against that two-gap scheme that the Iowa plays on the defensive line. And then I thought a couple of the guys really struggled. And I think part of that has to do with game scripts being put in man-to-man, you know, long passing situations. In other words, not talking three-step drop and quick outs when you're in not play action, just your straight drop back, 5-step, you know, long double moves, things like that. That's not set up for the Gophers to succeed in that situation. I think that's where they struggle the most. So, it was a challenge for them. And, you know, we talked a few weeks ago about this, you know, I call it the recalibration. You know, when you play a 7 or 8 games versus teams that are maybe of inferior talent, or maybe you know kind of match up, but then you step up to Penn State and Iowa, and speaking on their defense specifically, it's on a different level. And so this is a good learning experience for them. You learn how to play against maybe a guy that's more athletic and faster than you are, definitely better than anybody you've seen, you know, previously. And you know, I'm not trying to sugarcoat it, but it's, you have to learn how to play it and learn what you can get away with, what you have to do to compensate. And there were, you know, plenty of those moments on Saturday. So I don't think, you know, I don't think it was a case of missed assignments or lack of effort, but it was a tough matchup for him. And again, I'll just say it one last time and then I'll let it go. But the game script certainly didn't help him either, being down early.
Yeah, definitely. One thing I want to touch on, I know, Derek, you and I have talked about this offline. I don't know if we've talked about it on the podcast. So to those people that if we have talked about it and we're rehashing again, I'm sorry. But I did want to touch on just the fact that, you know, the Gophers have spent a lot of timeouts this season. One, because, you know, they're getting late into a play clock and they have to call a timeout because they're going to lose the opportunity. You know, they're more likely to take that timeout in the first half than the second half. But again, this is another situation where they seem to call in some sort of audible, et cetera, and or the play gets in late. You know, what's going into that, Derek? Why are they struggling so much, maybe more frequently in the first half than the second half, to get those plays in or change up a call on the fly?
Yeah, well, it's and we can talk about it maybe later when we talk coaching decisions, because I think one of those timeouts in the second half was totally inexcusable. But just to give a little bit of background on what the Gophers do on offense with the RPO offense, is it's based on getting the defense to line up against your formation. Then you look to the sideline. A play is essentially, it's like a no huddle. It is a no huddle offense, but it's almost, most of the time that snap is being made under 10 seconds. So you wait for the defense to line up and you get the play in. And if that communication and that isn't in quick enough, and especially if there's like a 2-check, you know, where you're signaling in 2 plays and then the quarterback has to decide which of those 2 plays to call based on the defensive formation, that's where you run into those situations. So they get lined up, they look at the defense, they wait for the defense to shift at times, sometimes they'll motion, and then they look back over. And if that doesn't line up correctly, then it gets late in the play clock. And what P.J. Fleck has had a history of is he likes to use a timeout in order to get out of a bad situation. He won't usually take a delay of game or won't stay with a bad play because he values, you know, either a loss of 5 yards in the delay of game or potentially you know, having a minus yard play or a busted play if it's not the right play for the defense. So that's what historically has gone on, and maybe a little bit of reasoning why they do that more than other teams.
On that specific play call, I do want to know what was probably the case and why Minnesota was adjusting so late. Number one, it was egregious that they didn't get the audible in until about 9 seconds on the play clock. I had that in my GIF rewinds on Gopher Illustrated, but if you look at the look that Iowa gave there and what the probable look was for Minnesota there, I can see why they wanted to audible, because what Iowa did there is they had two in the A gap, two in the B gap, and then they also had, I believe, wide sevens or wide nines. Plus, they had a linebacker over the top. What did Minnesota have to counter that? They had two, I think it was a 3-by-1 set with no tight end and shotgun Rodney Smith. So you are minus two in the box, and what Minnesota was probably going to was inside zone. Inside zone at the 1 yard line, when you're minus two in terms of blocking in the box there, Derek doesn't have to be an elite football mind to tell you that is not a plus EV look for Minnesota. Now, it's terrible that they didn't get that audible in until about 8 seconds left. That needs to be in at 18 seconds left. But kind of seeing, you know, knowing kind of some things there, it's just not going to work. Inside zone in that instance with double A's, double B's, and two guys that are going to seal the edge, even if Morgan does pull, that's why that wasn't going to look. Now, we'll get into the timeout a little bit later, Luke, but I wasn't a big fan of that.
All right, Ryan, so I'm just going to audible here on you real quick that you've got about 9 seconds left to get in this spot to, you know, to change your insurance. So if you could do that real quick, that'd be great.
Absolutely. So another one of our sponsors is the Burns Insurance Agency, owned by my father, Bill Burns, who wants to remind Gopher fans that just because the Gophers aren't perfect anymore, who of us in life is? And with life's less than perfect moments, having an insurance policy there to pick you up and give you the ability to brush yourself off and start 0-0 again on a given week is crucial. Now, the Burns Insurance Agency prides itself on helping you protect your business, your auto, your home, your cabins, your boat in those less than perfect times. So as the 9-1 Gophers are going to roll into Ryan Field at Northwestern on Saturday and try to take care of business, you should let the Burns Insurance Agency take care of your business or personal insurance needs. So if you're looking for a free quote and to save potentially hundreds, if not thousands of dollars on your business, your auto, or your home insurance, give them a look at insurancebyburns.com.
All right, so the Gophers got down early. The defense didn't have a great start. We better talk about that a little bit. So one, I know, Derek, you already kind of let the cat out of the bag. We weren't talking a little earlier, but Nathan Stanley was pretty good, and the Gophers weren't particularly great on defense. So what happened in that first half, and then, you know, what changes that they made to kind of shore things up and only give up 3 points in the second half?
Well, I think there were two main factors in the first half. The first, this is a Gopher podcast, so this is probably a comment that's not going to make people happy, but that was nothing short of an incredible game plan from Gophers, from Iowa, offensive coaches. And I really mean that. They had scouted the Gophers well. They had a game plan. They knew what they were going to counter with when the Gophers showed different defensive looks, and they executed pretty much flawlessly for the first three drives. So a little bit of detail behind that: when the Gophers ran man coverage and running down the distances, Iowa came back with things like long play action, double moves, long routes, threw the ball deep. And even though they didn't complete a lot of those, that's enough to scare a defense out of some of those coverages. And then when the Gophers ran zone passing, they sat back and they ran their zone busting routes. And Nate Stanley, who just played an incredible game from an accuracy standpoint, just was able to pick apart the zone. And so, as far as running the ball, when Minnesota was back, in a softer look, they ran right at Minnesota. When Minnesota was in an aggressive run look, they came back with a lot of counters in this direction and really took advantage of the Gophers over pursuing. So again, just an exceptional game plan from the Iowa coaching staff on offense in the first half. Now, the other part of it, I think, that was a big factor is Minnesota was very basic and very conservative in the first half. And I think it goes back to what we talked about with recalibration. The first eight games of the season, Minnesota is able to play a lot of base coverage, a lot of base packages, able to play in passing down in distances. They can rush four. They were getting more of a pass rush out of those front four, so they can sit back in coverage. They can drop eight guys and drop seven guys in the coverage. In this game, because of the way that Nate Stanley was throwing the ball, they weren't able to do that. And so they weren't aggressive enough in the first half, and that really hurt them because Iowa was able to move the ball downfield and move it quickly and efficiently. So I think that was the story of the first half. Now, in the second half, what they did was completely switched up and were able to manufacture pressure on the quarterback in the second half, and I think that made all the difference. Iowa probably got a little bit more conservative because they had a lead. That's what they do. They want to limit possessions and run the clock, but Minnesota switched things up, started bringing more blitzes, started getting more creative with their pass rushes, and were able to get more pressure, and that threw them off schedule, and I think was the change in the second half and really gave Minnesota a chance to get back in the game and bring it to within a one-score game. And so kind of two sides of the coin. You have to give them credit for making those changes in the second half and stiffening up, but I think if they had to do it over again with the 2020 hindsight, they were too conservative in the first half, and it really hurt them down the stretch.
Even on that first drive, Minnesota had numerous opportunities to get off the field, and they just couldn't do it. The first third down for Iowa, they go with that pitch, and both Winston and Sorry Marin both think that they don't have the outside guy, when in reality, I believe that's going to be Winston's guy. But Winston just kind of pinches down, doesn't pay any attention to the pitch, and Goodson has forever to run, and he gets 25, 30 yards. That's a third down conversion. And then you have one near midfield where Boye Mafe, who, by the way, continues to play really well on these limited snaps, just destroys the right guard. And Stanley sees him coming, and he just does the veteran thing. And he takes one step to the right, doesn't get phased, keeps his eyes down the field. Coughlin spins just a hair too early. And then as Mafe tries to come back and sack the quarterback, I believe it was Tristan Wirfs who was the left tackle. He tries to put Coughlin on the ground, and so he goes to the ground himself. So as Mafe is chasing Nathan Stanley to try and get the sack, he dives horizontally. Well, he doesn't know that Tristan Wirfs is going to pop up. And so as Mafe tries to grab him by the ankles, Wirfs pops up from underneath him, and he goes vertical instead of horizontal. Stanley escapes, and Iowa gets another conversion, and they eventually score. That was the story of the game for Minnesota on offense and defense. Is they were in position to make plays, they just couldn't make them.
Yeah, they definitely couldn't, and that was kind of the story of the whole game, both offensively, defensively, and special teams and coaching. Right, defensively for me, one of the things that I was curious about was specifically, I guess I was surprised, and I don't know if this caught the Gophers by surprise, Ryan, but I was surprised with their skill players. I thought that Tyler Goodson in particular was a little quicker. I hadn't watched Iowa really all season, but even some of their receivers, I was really impressed with some of what we saw out of their offensive guys, especially early. I know that the Gophers kind of put the clamps down in the second half, but I was impressed with some of those skill guys.
Yeah, Tyler Goodson is going to be a good player for them. He was their primary back on the day. And what Iowa had been running coming into this game was essentially a three-headed running attack that everybody got between 7 and 10 touches a game. They weren't doing a lot with it, but it was clear in recent weeks that Goodson was doing the most with it. And Iowa came out with a game plan to feature him. He gets 13 touches. Mekhi Sargent gets 6. And that was the only thing. And so, yeah, Goodson was pretty good. Tyrone Tracy and Amir Marcet-Smith, or Smith-Marset, they can do some things on the outside. You saw them be able to turn the Gopher corners a couple times. Nathan Stanley missed them on some throws. But it for Nathan Stanley on the day, too, while he missed some throws to start the game, he really got settled in, and he made some throws that make you think, like, this guy's a really good player, and that's why he's the starting quarterback at Iowa. But, yeah, Luke, it's Goodson and Tracy are both freshmen. Smith-Marset, a former Gopher commit for about 48 hours back in 2017. He's a pretty good player, too. So, yeah, they got some young skill guys that were giving Minnesota fits. But that being said, even on Goodson's touchdown run to the outside, Winston misses him for a tackle for loss. Chris Williamson is right there. He misses him for a tackle for loss. And then St. Juice gets held on the outside, nothing called. Even still, the Gopher defenders were in position to make plays on those first three drives. They just couldn't get out of their own way. And it was frustrating at times, Derek.
Yeah, what Iowa does, just touching on the running game quickly, what Iowa does with their zone scheme, they run it out of two back and one back, is they really make you defend every gap. And although guys are in position, when they run a misdirection, if you're overplaying, if you're trying to overplay that stretch outside zone that they run and they come back with that toss play or a misdirection and you're overplaying it, they're going to catch you. And so with these athletes that Luke mentioned, if they just get a half a step or get a little bit of an angle, and you're not set up properly, they're going to have a missed tackle and they're going to be breaking into the secondary. And that's been their, forte for, you know, this program's regime. And I guess the last thing I would add is something that just about Iowa in general, but I guess it applies to the offense as well, is they're a team that usually always gets better as the season goes on. I think that they're a very fundamentally based coaching staff, and I think they add things slowly throughout the season. And how many times have we seen an Iowa team lose to a MAC team early in the season or start slow and everybody's saying, well, they're no good this year, you can write them off. And by the end of the year, when October and November comes around, and these games specifically at home for Iowa, they can battle teams. And I think this year is no different. As the season wore on, they lose by one score to Wisconsin at Wisconsin, which is a very good Wisconsin team. And then, you know, obviously beat Minnesota the next week in a November game. And so I think you're seeing what they're also known for is they just continue to add complexity, develop guys, become fundamentally sound, and then some of these guys, these skill position guys that they feature later in the season, can get you by surprise.
Derek, I did want you to get you to touch on defensively. Like, was there a position unit that played really well in this game, or maybe even a couple guys that just stood out to you on the defensive side of the ball for the Gophers?
Yeah, I actually thought the defensive line was in good position, well coached, and played really hard. I think pick out a couple of guys in the run defensive game. I thought Micah Dutredway played maybe one of his best games. You can tell that they were coached to defend the outside stretch running play that Iowa runs. And those interior guys really did a good job of turning and chasing. Sam Renner chased down a couple of outside zone plays. Micah was there, blew up his blocker a few times. And then in the pass defensive game, as Ryan already touched on, Boye Mafe, Carter Coughlin, you know, which is no surprise, continues to be a factor. So I thought, for as well as the Iowa offensive line is regarded, I thought the Minnesota defensive line met the challenge and played really well.
All right, Ryan, I do want you to touch on, you know, the second half. The Gophers, you know, really did put down the clamps. I know they made some changes, got a little bit more aggressive. I know PJ said, I believe it was his press conference, that they probably should have adjusted earlier. But how good were they in the second half on defense?
I mean, essentially after those first three scoring drives, Minnesota just didn't allow Iowa to do anything. Now, Iowa went conservative because they didn't want to lose the game, and they knew that they had a two or three score lead at times, but we're talking about on Iowa's final 30 plays of the game, they put up 85 yards total. That's it, and 3 points. So is it inexcusable to have an inefficient Iowa offense to score three touchdowns on you to start the game? Sure. Absolutely. I'm with you. I wrote about that on Gopher Illustrated. That can't happen, especially if you're expecting to beat a really good Iowa team at home, where they're very, very tough to beat. Now, did the Gophers adjust in those final six, seven, eight drives of the game and allow them only 85 yards and 3 points? Absolutely. And that's something that they have to take credit for. Now, I didn't think that particularly the linebackers had their greatest games, or St. Juice or Keandre Thomas or Terrell Smith. They got turned around a little bit too much for my liking. But as a whole, you saw this Minnesota defense really come to life after those three drives, and really once Iowa started to get near midfield, then Minnesota was getting home on blitzes. you are really seeing Joe Rossi put Braylon Oliver into that Blake Cashman type of role where he doesn't have to think too much. He just says, go sick the quarterback. And he's pretty good at doing that.
It's wild it's wild that you said that, because I actually said that out loud twice in the last two. Well, one in each of the last two games.
Well, it's something that I think we've talked about them on this podcast. Derek and I talked about it today before the show, is that especially for a young player, if you don't ask him to do too much, and for Braylon Oliver, if you don't ask him to read a defense or read what the offense is trying to do, and you can just put him out there on passing downs and say, hey, go get that quarterback. Here's the stunt you're going to do. I want you to be as physical as you can and go try to get home on the quarterback. That's pretty easy to do for a young player. So the defense does deserve credit for keeping Minnesota in this game as long as they did, especially with the inefficiencies on the offensive side of the ball. But ultimately, it comes down to Iowa was operating at a different level on those first three drives because they had schemed it so well. Minnesota certainly needs to adjust much sooner than that going forward.
All right, you guys got anything else you want to touch on defensively? Otherwise, we'll jump to coaching, special teams, going once, going twice. Okay, so real quickly, the Goal Line Club, again, sponsoring the 2019 season. If you want to hit up the tailgate or the preview, there will be a preview, even though it is going to be Thanksgiving week with Wisconsin. You can use the promo code AXED5, that's AXED and the number 5. I just want to say, like, Ryan and I are really excited to be working, one, with the Goal Line Club, hopefully have some things in the works down the pipeline, hopefully helping them to get more and more events, etc., which would be really fun. But we are really encouraged with all of you that responded on Give to the Max Day. I know that the folks at the Goal Line Club are jazzed as well, and this benefits the football team in a really meaningful way. One of those meaningful ways is they're able to, you know, get coats for parents of players who maybe come from out of town to watch a game and they may not have a coat, for instance. There are a number of other things that they're able to support PJ Fleck and the football team. And it's really meaningful ways. It's not just dumb stuff, right? It's not like eight different flavors of bubble gum or whatever, right? So again, if you want to join any of the opportunities that they have for events or just support the football team in a meaningful way, go to goalineclub.org. All right. Special teams, Ryan. Here's your soapbox. Get on it. Go for it.
Sorry. So are we going to talk about why... How hot does Rob Wenger's seat have to be? Because if it's scalding, I don't know what to tell you anymore. I've talked about it every week. I love each and every one of you that tweet me after every single special teams gaffe. But as laughable as it is and as much joy as I potentially get in it that folks are realizing that special teams is really bad here, they continue to be really bad here, and we're 10 games into the season, and they haven't gotten any better. We can talk about the PAT game where a 50-yard field goal in Kinnick is a tough ask. I get it. But then you also have one boink off the upright that goes in for the chippy, and then when you score a touchdown with 3 minutes left in the game, you miss the extra point. Come on. And then Jacob Herbers saves a bad snap, but Oh, Jacob Herbers. Minnesota needs you to flip the field in the fourth quarter. And what do? You just absolutely lift a booming punt 32 flipping yards. And then Minnesota's punt unit gets in kick-catch interference. It's so laughable at this point. They are second to worst in net punt, second to worst in kickoff return average. They are the worst in punt return average. It's the kickoff unit isn't anything to write home about. Like, what are we – what I don't know what else to say about this special teams unit. I looked at ESPN's – I forget if it was S&P or if it was FPI today, Luke. Out of 130 FBS teams, you want to know what Minnesota's special teams is ranked as we sit here today?
I'll go 100+.
It is 128th. That's bleeping awful. And it hasn't gotten any better. Punt game sucks. The field goal unit isn't reliable. We've seen block kicks. We've seen essentially everything that can go wrong, go wrong. And this was finally one of the games where it touched the flipping stove. You finally got burnt. So why – I'm running out of words to say about special teams. So, Derek, can you please save me?
Well, I just – here. This is my – this is where I'm at. We just completed week 10. I know there are a lot of young guys that playing on special teams. That's what this coaching staff does. They play the younger guys in special teams, and sometimes they play even the red shirts for four games. And then as the season goes on, they rotate in a new group of guys. And so there's something to be said for that. But where I'm at is we just completed week 10, and I just don't think things have improved. And we're at a point where we're asking to maybe just asking to be average. I mean, it's, you know, they're not scoring, you know, on kick returns, punt returns. They're not having explosive plays. They're not blocking punts, and all that is a dream, a pipe dream right now. What we're asking for is just, as Ryan touched on, is to just stop making some of the basic mistakes.
Can you be competent? We're not asking for you to be, I don't even know what a great special teams looks like considering the Vikings debacle today, but can you just be average? You don't have to be elite.
Well, there's like,
just, can you be competent?
There's a couple ways that you can approach special teams, right? You can play starters, right? That's like what Virginia Tech used to do under I can't even remember their head coach's name, but they'd play like everybody on special teams and they'd be elite, right? And then there's the approach, Derek, you've touched on. But yeah, I mean, they haven't been competent. Here's a question I have for you, Ryan, because I don't know the roster well enough. I know that he recruited, that PJ recruited Lance, right? But effectively he's inherited all of the special teams folks, and I know weeks, but like Peyton Jordahl was good. Emmett Carpenter was good, but neither of those guys were flat guys. Like, are we having to start to question like their ability to recruit kicking?
Ooh, that's a good question. Now, Michael Lance didn't make the trip to Iowa because of what the TV broadcast said was leg tightness. So I don't know if he pulled a muscle in his quad or what happened there.
And I'm not out on him. He hasn't been terrible. He's been a true freshman. Yeah.
And yeah, he had the big field goal against Fresno State.
Right.
He's been fine. I think the jury's out on Lance and Weeks. They're both true freshmen playing, and you got to give them more time, but I think the bigger question is, why has Jacob Herbers regressed significantly?
Or why has Jacob Herbers, you're his biggest like hater. Like, what, has he ever really been super, super good? I mean,
people love to point me to his 2018 stats, but even still,
even then it wasn't great.
It's been back-to-back weeks where Minnesota needs him to flip the field in a big spot against Penn State and Iowa. And he, I would say, shanks it, but I don't think it's truly a shank. I don't know that he literally has the leg strength.
Well, I guess the question is, like, why is there nobody pushing him?
Why isn't there another option?
Yeah, right.
That's a great question. They have Alex Melvin, who is a graduate transfer, who's there. I wouldn't be opposed to see someone else besides Jacob Herbers get a kick. I really wouldn't. But it also comes down to, why are the return games so anemic? Why can't Minnesota figure – you know what the way is to beat Minnesota's kickoff return, Luke? You pooch it.
Yeah.
You've seen that, I think, 2 or 3 weeks in a row now where you pooch it and it starts rolling it to 20 or 15 and Minnesota's kickoff returner can't field it cleanly. So they bobble it for a couple seconds. And then by the time they get it cleanly, the kickoff unit is on top of them and Minnesota starts at their own 10 or 15 yard line.
So
that's happened numerous weeks.
So let's look at it this way. Like, this is just my observation. I don't have any data to support this, but it feels like their general strategy on kick return and punt return are both this: one, secure the ball and don't turn it over, right? So with punt, it's basically fair catch, right? And on kickoff return, it's basically, if you're in the end zone at all, take a knee or just let it go through the end zone. And so I understand what they're doing. Yeah, I understand what other teams are doing from a kick perspective. They're trying to kick it short because, you know, we haven't proved that we can take it back. But I don't understand the general strategy either.
On the punt return one, here's been my observations is Minnesota doesn't try to block the kick, but they also don't try to block a return. They are in their safe punt return defense a ton, which means that they really don't want to get beat on a fake. Now, I don't know who hurt them that hard. Like, who hurt you every time, like 50% of the time, you have to be in safe punt return where you're not trying to block the kick, you're not trying to set up a return. I have no idea. Like you mentioned, Luke, the strategy seems to be just don't screw up, which that's not the way special teams should be. And Minnesota really hasn't bobbled too many returns in turn. Well, I say that as the pooch kick strategy, and I think Demetrius Douglas bobbled one a couple weeks ago. But even still, these special teams have not gotten any better since game one. If anything, they have regressed. And why is Fleck not holding Rob Wenger? Why is he not being questioned about this? Because here we are with 2 weeks to go. You can say what you will about the Northwestern game. It's essentially meaningless. The Wisconsin game at home, you're going to need special teams to be adequate to win that game, and I have zero trust that they can do that.
All right, so let's talk a little bit of coaching, because there are a number of things to touch on here, and it's something we used to feature regularly. It's funny we haven't talked about that, I guess, when we're winning. But let's put it this way. There are a number of instances where people could question coaching decisions here. We already alluded to the timeout. I don't know, Derek, if you want to take us through that quick and give your thoughts on the use of that timeout.
Well, I think it was that of all the decisions was the one I was most disappointed in. 1 yard line late in the game, you're down and you know you're going to need that timeout is precious because Iowa, being who they are, is going to try and, you know, eat the clock when they get the ball back. And if you have two timeouts, it's going to save you 40 seconds. And, where I'm at is, and Ryan pointed it out well, they did not have the right play call to the defense and didn't have time to get the audible in quick enough, but where I'm at is just run the play, run inside zone. If you get stuffed, that's fine. It's getting stuffed for no gain or even 1 yard or even a 2 yard loss, which sets you up at second goal from the three. In my opinion, in keeping the timeout is better. So I didn't agree with that decision. And I thought, you know, I guess we could debate whether a delay of game, which would put you at the first and goal on the six, if that's even better than wasting the timeout. But I think that was the one I was most disappointed by.
I think it's absolutely worth backing up 5 yards to keep that timeout in your pocket. If you don't trust your offense that had been high-flying, explosive, and good all year. Now, I understand they had been inefficient in this game, and you got to play for the situation. But if there's an offense that I would trust to get 6 yards, it's going to be this go for 2019 offense. They just didn't execute at times. In that second timeout, you change the field position game. You absolutely change the field position game because Fleck decides to go for the onside knowing I only have one timeout in my pocket. If they get a first down, they can win the game. They will win the game. And if I have that second timeout in my pocket, I probably kick it deep, try to make Iowa get a first down way deep in their territory. You know they're going to play conservative because they're not going to want to screw this up. Now, we also can come back down to Fleck obviously doesn't know that Brock Walker is going to miss wide left. So instead of trying to go 30 yards for a field goal in field position game, you're going to have to drive 60 to get a touchdown, but welcome to go for special teams once again. I would much rather take the delay of game in that circumstance just to go back 5 yards and have the offense, which is probably going to pass the ball in that scenario. You're only saving yourself a 5, 10, 15, 20 seconds maybe, but that timeout in that instance is just so valuable that I really didn't like him using it there.
All right, so let's go to 4th and 13 on the first possession of the game for the Gophers. They're at the Iowa 32. They attempt a 50-yard Brock Walker field goal. Now, again, Brock Walker, I believe, is a freshman. He didn't win the job outright, so he goes up, misses the field goal. What were your thoughts on that, Derek?
Another one I didn't agree with, and that's not, you know, with the benefit of 2020 hindsight. I think a 50-yard field goal on the road at an outdoor stadium, I don't know what the wind conditions were, but I don't think that was advisable. You know, Iowa was the way they moved the ball, especially in the first half, giving them a shorter field on the miss. I guess if, you know, I'm trying to put myself in the mind of the Gopher coaching staff, they might be trying to give a shot in the arm to, you know, a new kicker, you know, get on the board, obviously. And so there's some upside there, but I think, a risky call at best. And I don't think the kick was close. So, it ended up being, so I don't know what was going on in warmups, if they saw something that, and they felt like they had a better shot at it, but I didn't agree with that one.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, they used the timeout to then kick the field goal, right?
Oh, they certainly did. They certainly did. Now, I'll say this. I've seen Brock Walker in practice make 50-yard field goals with these. I thought it was a really close competition between him and Lance. To be honest, I don't see much of a difference between him and Lance. And I'd even say maybe Walker has the better leg between the two of them. So I get going for it. Or I get kicking the field goal. But I don't think you're putting that young man in an advantageous situation. He played in one game where he made a chip shot field goal and the extra points. To then expect him to go on the road in a hostile environment with all the pressure in the world on him and try to make one from 50, like he doesn't have an extra point to warm up in a game situation, a short field goal or anything like that. That's a tough ask, and I would rather you almost arm punt it in that scenario where it's 4th and 13 from the Iowa 32. Either you have to try to pin them inside the five with Jacob Herbers and his leg strength, or you just take a shot towards the end zone, and worst case, it's an interception, and then you tackle them inside the 20, and it's essentially an arm punt. So, of course, hindsight's 20/20, but even at the time, I think you can go back and look at the tweets. I really wasn't a big fan of putting Walker in that scenario, as I don't think it's advantageous.
All right, so let's go to, what is this, the third possession for the Gophers, 4th and 18 at the Iowa 33. They punt a 31-yard punt down to the Iowa 2. Derek, what was your thought there?
I would have rather seen him go for it. I know 4th and 18, you don't have a lot of plays for that down in distance. But even if Ryan already mentioned arm punt, even if you're throwing something down the field, it gets intercepted, or even a catch and run might be decent in that scenario. You know, throw short of the first down sticks and hope that you can catch and run. And if you don't, you know, he gets caught short, that's fine. You know, it at least gives you a shot at getting the first down. But turning around and punting it, I didn't agree with that one either.
Punting it from your opponent's 33 when you're down 17 points, I don't know that I have words to describe what I think that's about. I think you're almost throwing in the towel. That's what it feels like. If I would be a player in that scenario, we're down 17 and we're punting from their 33. If there has ever been a Minnesota receiving corps and a quarterback that you can trust to potentially make a play, it's the 2019 Gopher quarterback and the 2019 Gopher receivers. Now, of course, in hindsight, how does it end up? Iowa can't do anything because they're pinned on their own end. Minnesota gets the ball back and they get 3 points before the half. But even still, with the way that this offense has played, and it's not like they were struggling to move the ball on the day. They put up 431 yards of total offense against this Iowa defense. They were averaging nearly 15 yards per completion. I really didn't like the punt call. Really, really didn't like it.
All right, let's go to it's 3-20. There's 2 seconds left in the half. The Gophers are on the 2-yard line, 1st and goal. We elect to kick a 20-yard Brock Walker field goal, which he makes. What are your thoughts there initially down 3-20 going into the half, Derek?
I didn't have a problem with this one. I think with the Gophers getting the ball back to start the second half, to bring it down to a 2-score game was important at that point. The way that we talked about the Gophers had struggled inside the 30-yard line with various gaffes, you know, a tip ball, a sack, you know, to come away at that point to go for it and come away with 0 points, I think is a bigger momentum swing or a bigger, you know, downside for the offense, and then to have to come back and score to make it a 2-possession game to start the second half would be a bigger uphill climb. So I might be in the minority on that one, but I didn't have an issue with it.
The key word there being you get the ball to start the second half. If you don't, you absolutely have to go for that. But the fact that you can kick a field goal, make it a two-possession game, and you get the ball to start the second half, you absolutely have to take the points there. You absolutely do. And I don't think there's really any question about that one.
All right. So lastly, I think this is kind of a dumb one, but it is a polarizing thing. Fleck running onto the field to the aid of Tyler Johnson, who I believe flopped a little bit on that. He did get roughed up, but definitely I thought maybe flopped a little bit. I know this is something that Fleck does normally, and I don't blame him for doing it. I think it's kind of cool that, you know, he makes a point to be there, you know, when guys go down and are injured. But you know, he was told that he ran out too fast onto the field. Thoughts from either of you on that? I think this one's really dumb.
Well, I think the thing that people need to understand is the thing I did not understand off the bat. I thought that Fleck cost them, with offsetting penalties, the ball back. That is not the case. PJ Fleck not running out onto the field. If he does not, in that instance, it's still Iowa's ball. Because the late hit was deemed a dead ball foul, while PJ running out onto the field to see if Tyler's okay was also a dead ball foul. Now, I agree that there should have been a flag there, that the hit was late, it was unnecessary, and I think that's the key word there, is it should have been unnecessary roughness as a result of a live play. And if that's the case, Minnesota gets the ball back with that late flag. But I think the referee crew screwed up. They're calling it unsportsmanlike conduct, dead ball. I don't agree with that one bit. Now, that's the biggest thing I want you to take away here is, PJ Fleck did not cost his team the ball. They were both fouls on the play were dead ball. He cost them field position, and by them, Iowa's offense. That's the biggest thing you need to take away from this. And I understand that Fleck was, I mean, we've seen PJ do that the entire time. Now, you'd like to see that, you know, Tyler was bouncing up and Fleck was probably pretty emotional just because Minnesota doesn't get that play. And he did see Tyler down on the ground, but you'd like to see him kind of wait another 1 or 2 seconds to see if Tyler's going to get up or not. But even still, I understand why he did it. He's done it all year. He did it all game again. But Derek, what did you think?
Well, a couple things. The key, and I know this goes without saying, but just feel like I need to point it out. The key on the play was the drop pass. So we can talk about the penalties, but right. the play, the result of the play.
It's a touchdown, probably.
Right.
And then it's a tie right. game late in the third quarter, and Minnesota has all the momentum in the world.
Yep. So that's really the key in the play. And Fleck penalty, as you pointed out, not only did it not affect the possession, but it really didn't have any effect on the game. I know it's a big talker for people because it involves the head coach, and it's a rare penalty that a coach gets an unsportsmanlike. So people, I think, are trying to – they're trying to make it into a talking point. I just didn't think it had much of an effect on the game. Now, in terms of, I agree with you. I think if there's any quote controversy, I don't really understand the unsportsmanlike after the play call. It seemed like it was, I realize the play is over when the ball touches the ground after an incomplete pass.
Yeah.
But usually a bang bang play like that is considered either targeting or unnecessary roughness. So I'm not sure what the explanation the Gophers got or are going to get from the league office this week. But then on Fleck's penalty, I wasn't at the game, and with the television cameras and the commentary, it was difficult to pick up. But this is kind of my guess. I could be wrong, but this is my guess on that penalty. Usually with an injured player, at the end of a play, especially a ball out of bounds or anything that stops the clock, in this case, a change of possession, the whistle is blown to end the play. If there's an injured player, the head referee usually blows the whistle and signals stoppage again for a media timeout or an official's timeout for an injured player. I believe that Fleck ran out onto the field after the first whistle, but before the official's timeout. And I think that's why he got the penalty. Now, I wasn't there. I didn't have the benefit of the replay, but I could see that happening. And I don't know if you guys if you've been in a game live, it's easier to see that when you're at a game live. A play gets over, they blow the whistle for the play being over. There's a guy on the ground. Somebody notices it, and then the head official signals official's timeout for an injury. And it's usually 5 to 6 seconds later. And so I think Fleck got out there before that happened, and that was probably the basis for the penalty.
All right, that was kind of fun. We probably should talk more coaching stuff in the future, even when they win, because it's kind of fun to question it with hindsight because it makes us look like we're really smart. But that said, okay, so let's transition. Looking forward to the next 2 weeks. I'm going to read a tweet that my wife wrote last night. I don't know if many people are like me, but I almost always talk to my dad after Gopher football and Gopher basketball games because he kind of instilled that that love for Gopher sports in me. And so we talk most of the times, and apparently my wife overheard me say that we control our own destiny. And she said that although this is somehow related to Gopher football, it's also a good Saturday evening affirmation. And I do believe it is true. Keep in mind, everybody, that we do still control our own destiny. That's awesome, right? We are currently sitting on top of the Big Ten West. I did not have that. I did not expect that coming into this season. I know Ryan did because he does this for his full-time job. But I'll say this much. If you win, you win the Big Ten West, and that's amazing. I'm excited for the next 2 weeks. I know it's a bummer that they lost to Iowa, but you know the dream is not dead.
No, does it suck that Minnesota now can't control their own destiny sooner? In terms of if you win that game at Iowa, and then you beat Northwestern on the road, you then clinch it before Wisconsin. Sure, I ain't going to be one to disagree with you there. But that being said, this loss just all it does essentially. It does. I mean, in theory, it does not take you out of the college football playoff discussion. If you run the table against Northwestern, Wisconsin, and you somehow with a chip and a chair, tip chair and a chance, beat Ohio State in that Big Ten championship game, you have a hard time finding me saying that Minnesota shouldn't be heading to the playoff. Now, if you beat Northwestern, I shouldn't say that the Northwestern game this weekend is insignificant because
it's still significant.
It is. To an extent,
you're going to get to 10 wins, Ryan. That matters.
Yes, and it'll be the first time that's happened in a regular season since 1904, or I think, actually, excuse me, 1905. But the Wisconsin game is now for everything. It is for the Axe, for Minnesota to keep it in Dinkytown two consecutive years. It's for the Big Ten West, assuming that Wisconsin doesn't slip up at home against a bad Purdue team. And I would not be surprised one bit if College Game Day is in town for that Wisconsin game. Now, nothing is official, but I know that there have been some serious inquiries behind the scenes about if Minnesota, you know, and Wisconsin want to do this thing on College Game Day. So that'll be another thing to watch. But it's Minnesota-Wisconsin for the Axe now. That's for the Axe, for a trip to Indianapolis, and maybe even more big picture for some of you for the Rose Bowl. I firmly believe the winner of this game outside of Penn State upsetting Ohio State is going to be heading to the Rose Bowl. So if that game couldn't get any bigger for November 30th with everything I just mentioned, with the Rose Bowl, the Big Ten West, the Axe on the line, potentially College Game Day in town, if you aren't getting your tush to TCF Bank Stadium for that game, if you thought the Penn State game was big, which it was, and the atmosphere was incredible, this game needs to be even on top of that, if this team is going to beat a pretty good Wisconsin team at home that day and try to secure a bid to Indianapolis.
All right, Mr. Derek Burns, any parting thoughts?
Well, I would just add, I know we've maybe beat this into the ground on previous podcasts, but just real quick, I want to mention again, we talk a lot about trajectory going into November, and then I've talked a lot about my beliefs on winning in November. And just to restate that, this is not the NFL. In college football, the teams that win in November almost always are the teams that end up winning the division, securing better bowl bids. You just simply can't back into a championship in college football. It's not the NFL where 38% of the teams go to the playoffs. And here we are again, with the Gophers, with a huge win against Penn State, they've set themselves up well. They're on a good trajectory. They lose a tough game on the road at Iowa, but here we are again. They have to win in November against the rival Wisconsin to win the division and ultimately play for the conference championship. And that's, before the season even started, I would have guessed that you know, it would come down to team, you know, the top two or three teams being able to win. Whoever wins in November is the team that's going to be able to play in the Big Ten championship game. So that's why I love college football. It's great for, I think, for Gopher fans to, including myself, to experience something like this. It's kind of rare territory. We're in such an odd place that we're very disappointed, including myself, you know, disappointed and frustrated in the last game. But here we are. We're 9-1. I mean, the season has already reached a level that I think probably meets or definitely exceeds a lot of fans' expectations. So we have to keep that in perspective and do what we can to enjoy the final 2 weeks, because this is what makes, in my opinion, what makes college football great, is being in a race and in a competition like this.
All right, so I want to cordially invite both of you over to my place to watch the seedings come down for the college football playoff on Tuesday. I think now that with a quality loss on the Gophers' resume, I got to imagine they're going to move up into the top five. Your thoughts?
Where do you think they put Minnesota? I think they should be 9 or 10. I wouldn't be mad at 11, where they're currently ranked in the polls. But if they somehow fall to 13, 14, 15, and both Penn State and Wisconsin are in front of them, what was already a joke becomes a laughing stock. But Derek, what do you think?
Well, I'll be frank in that you guys probably have forgotten more about the college playoff system than I know, because I haven't chosen to focus on that too much, so I don't know much about the ins and outs. But if there's anything I guess I'm a little bit disappointed in, is that the things that when they debuted the system and came up with the system, the things that they talked about the committee focusing on are really not what's happening. They talked about winning conference games, strength of schedule, things like that. And now it seems to be this discussion about eye tests and quality losses and all these things that are just kind of puzzling, to be honest. And I don't know if it was the last year or the year before. I think it was 2 years ago. I don't remember the teams involved, but there were a switch in rankings in the final week, which is all that matters in the end. And that were really just kind of out of left field, which goes to show you that there's just so much subjectivity involved. I think everybody, you know, who's in tune with college football has their own, you know, way that they want to fix this. But my 2 cents would be to attach more of a system, an objective system to it, whether that's a point system or giving points for strength of schedule or wins versus such and such opponents, so that there's qualifications that are met. I mean, the system that we have now, it just seems to kind of float around. Maybe it makes for good media and makes for good ratings and things like that, but it's kind of anybody's guess at this point.
Are you submitting that we should actually go back to, was it the BCS rankings where we'd wait and then there'd be, you know, some computer number crunching, etc.? Is that what you want, Derek?
Go ahead, Ryan.
Well, you just put it to 8. The Power 5 champions each gets in.
Sure.
And you get, if you want to put a group of 5 in there, if they're deserving, I think you do Power 5 winners, and you do the top 3 ranked from there. And that's how you fix it, because there's so much subjectivity with 4, but with 8, there really isn't to me.
Yeah, and I don't know, just to answer your question, Luke, I think the problem with the system before is that nobody knew what those measurements were.
Right.
I think if there was a little more transparency into the measurement system, I think they could start with things like, I really think that they should push for all Power 5 conferences to have a little bit more consistency with scheduling. I know that the Big Ten, when they renegotiated their television contract, they made a push for strengthening the schedules, in other words, going to 9 conference games, eliminating FCS teams from the non-conference schedules beginning in, I can't remember what year. So, and I think those things were great for the fans, to be honest. It makes for better television, better viewership, better games. But the SEC and other conferences are not on board with that. And to be honest, the system that they have now is working for the SEC. So I don't know. Of course, they're not going to change. So there's things like that they could take some small steps to, you know, to providing a little bit more parity. And I just think it's interesting that the scheduling thing always comes up when the traditional powerhouses have a tougher schedule. Then they always talk about, well, we should really even the schedules out. And then in the years where they have a favorable schedule, it's never mentioned. But yeah, so there's things to tweak, and it makes for a good discussion. But
I mean,
maybe
we're talking
to circle
about
back
it.
To your original point. Yeah. I mean, to circle back to your original point, I think the Gophers, I could see them anywhere from 9 to 9, 10, 11, something like that would be my guess. If it's outside of that, I think that's maybe that'll create more articles and more talking if they're outside of that.
All right. So just to close out, we want to thank everybody for listening. We appreciate, we really do appreciate it. It's been really fun this season to talk about Gopher football. It's also fun when they win a lot. Again, thank you so much for listening, and go Gophers.